I'm a chief director in the Department of Science and Innovation. Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members, honorable chair, deputy minister. My name is Khomotso Matlapeng and I work in the Science and Technology Indicators at the Department of Science and Innovation. Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you very much for the introduction. On the right side is the honorable members of parliament. I'm sure you know them. You can't vote for people that you don't know. So, yeah. Honorable Mananitso.
Thank you, Chair. I know we cannot contest apologies, but that one of catching a flight back home, it's not dwelling well with me. So what if we not finish at that time that they want to be excused? So who would need just to excuse them for them to catch a flight home? For now, I think what I can suggest is that they must check if what are the possibilities to have a later flight rather than the earlier flight. So the issue of catching a flight without any valid reason to say why do we want to catch a flight early to go home is something else that we cannot accept in this community.
Okay, I think let's proceed and get the presentations and let's see how far we go. I'm sure it was just a slip of a tongue. From the DDG, I take it he didn't really mean it. So it's okay. I think I want us to be in a good mood today. So let's proceed and hand over to the Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson and colleagues, members of parliament. I think we should always be in a good mood. Firstly, thank you for the opportunity for requesting the Department of Science and Technology still to make a presentation on what we think are three very important items. The team would obviously, I think, give us more details in terms of the three presentations. But I must indicate that one of government's major preoccupation is on ensuring that we grow our economy, we deal with inequality, poverty, and we see an economy that creates jobs. And those are important indicators for us because it means that the quality of life of the majority of South Africans would improve. And I think of crucial importance what we as observed in the last engagement the department had with the portfolio committee was the fact that research and development are going to play a crucial role if we are to grow the economy and also perform better in terms of all of those factors. Some of the biggest economies in the world, if we look at the US, if we look at China, are spending close to 2% already of their GDP on research and development. Countries in the continent are also already investing a lot of resources in the area of research and development, and South Africa has to play a leading role. And I think what we appreciate from the initiative of the portfolio committee is that it helped us to probe what are the possibilities and what are the probabilities if we are to attain, firstly, a 1.1% target of research and development within the medium-term strategy framework but also a 1.5% target by 2030 as set by the National Development Plan. So what the team from the department indicated to me was that these are mainly probabilities. And I think one of the biggest challenge that we have in government is the fact that although science, technology, innovation department is responsible for monitoring research and development in the country, and although our science and technology, both the white paper and the landscape and the strategy that we're engaging with, tries to go at length in ensuring that we provide leadership to the country on the area of research and development, we still lack in terms of that coherence. We think that the medium-term strategy framework, the current one, is providing that kind of direction. But we also will be doing our best as the ministry and the department to make sure that there is that level of coherence. Similarly, we appreciate the opportunity to present on the International Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology on the establishment of the ICGB component in South Africa, and also an opportunity to present on the consideration of the Science and Technology Law Amendment Bill. We believe that the bill is an opportunity for the department and ministry to begin to cohere all of the entities and agencies under the department and ministry. I think as we know that most of the entities are established by different legislation and make different provisions in terms of the boards, in terms of reporting, in terms of the appointments of senior management. We've had several challenges. So this process was initiated by the former Minister of Science and Technology, and we thought that it's quite important that we continue with this legislation. So the team will, I don't know how the chair wants us to do it. Should we deal with each presentation and then discuss? Or do you want us to take all the presentations at a go? I think we'll be guided by yourself.
Well, I don't know how long the presentations are going to be. I wanted to listen to the Science and Technology Amendment laws before I leave at 12. So I know the members, when they start engaging, they can go to town. So I think maybe let's receive all the presentations if members are fine, and then do the engagement after.
Okay, No, that's fine. I think we could try and keep the presentations between anything between 12 and 15 minutes, and then allow for engagement.
12 is, is it not going to be? Okay, let's just give them time. Present, but also not go to town, but
yeah.
Let's do justice to,
sure.
There's much work that has gone into preparing, so let's,
sure.
Let's do that.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I think we'll take them in that order.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, let's do the R&D and then the Laws Amendment Bill and then the Convention. Last. Okay, thank you, dear. TDG, there's one mic that's on. At the back there, yeah? It's like yesterday. All right.
Thank you, Chair. Godfrey and Ramotso would do the detailed presentation. They'll keep it brief as requested. But just to contextualize, as you had indicated, Chair, this request, in fact, came from the Portfolio Committee. And the way we understood the brief, Chair, was that there's a need to dig a bit deeper into this issue of the 1.1% and 1.5% target. This target has been in place for a while, but we haven't really achieved it. And part of what we have identified as a department is there's a need for broader understanding of what makes up the GERD number, particularly to convert the percentage, which is what people talk about, to talk about what does this mean in monetary value, in rand terms. What will it take for South Africa to achieve a 1.1% by 2024 and a 1.5% by 2024? If we focus on the rand value, it might be easier to engage with other actors, particularly other portfolio committees, other sectors like health, education, etc. Because ultimately, in order to achieve the 1.1% or the 1.5% target, is going to require a whole range of players, whether it's the university sector, whether it's the government, whether it's private sector, whether it's local government, provincial government, etc., to look at what is it that they can do to contribute to the GERD target. So this is a start of a process. This requires a lot more work, and more importantly, it requires engagement with other government departments to identify what is it that they can do in working with us to increase the R&D spend that they can make to their own sectors, which will support their own service delivery objectives, but at the same time help us to achieve our 1.5% target. So we are doing, basically presenting the outcomes of modeling work, because this is not something that you can project. You need to make a lot of assumptions about GDP growth and other numbers, and so the colleagues will not only present the results of the modeling, but also provide an indication of what are the assumptions that we use, so that in case the assumptions change, we will modify the modeling over the next few years as and when we get more information. So as I had indicated, this we see this as a start of a very strategic conversation with the Portfolio Committee on how we can work together to achieve that 1.1 and 1.5% target. So I think Godfrey and Khmotso will share the presentation between themselves.
Thank you, and once more, good morning. The presentation is titled... presentation is titled Estimation of Research and Development Target Investment Requirement. This, in terms of the purpose of the presentation, is a follow-up presentation to the Portfolio Committee's matter that was raised during the briefing on the 18th of September 2019. When the department presented the R&D tax incentive program briefing. In that meeting, the Portfolio Committee requested that the department presents what it would take to move from the current levels of R&D investment, which is 0.83% of GDP in 2017-18 measurement, to the targeted levels of R&D investment as a percentage of GDP. The PC, in our understanding, was keen to understand, to have a sense of what it means in terms of the quantum of the required additional investment in R&D in rand terms, which is what we are doing today. Although the agenda indicates that the DST must present specific strategies to achieve the 1.5% government set target, that work has not actually been done yet. Thus far, as the DDG has explained, we have the preliminary work which is unfolding in this space. which then becomes the focus of today's presentation. We are hoping that with the engagement that we're proposing in the conclusion of this presentation, if we execute those actions that we are proposing, we'll then be able to reflect and formulate proper strategies in this regard, taking into account also that the department is leading a process of planning the implementation of the 2019 white paper on science, technology and innovation in a form of producing what is called the decadal plan. We think that this target, because it's part of that, is integral to that a decadal plan of implementation, need to be properly aligned to whatever plans and strategies that are going to come out of that process. In terms of the overview, South Africa's National Development Plan sets goals for significantly reducing the levels of unemployment, poverty and inequality, and connected to that are the government strategies to increase productive investments, industrialization and improve competitiveness. All of these need to be achieved in the setting of inclusive growth and development. So increasing investment in R&D is integral to the policy approach for attaining these mentioned aims. Hence, we find that various policy documents in government have actually set some targets in this regard. For example, the 2002 National Research and Development Strategy had a target of 1%, at least 1%. The 2019 White Paper on Science and Technology makes expression on the 1.5% over the next decade and puts an aspirational target of 2%. The medium-term strategic framework projects GDP a target of 1.1% by 2024. So these have been taken into account. We try to synthesize this in the way we have structured the presentation today. We also thought, Honorable Chair and members and my colleagues, that we need to explain the concepts before we go into the meat of the presentation. One such important concept is the concept of GDR, the Gross Domestic Expenditure on Research and Development. This is an aggregated measure of R&D investment in an economy. It measures what we call the in-house R&D expenditure performed domestically by what we call the R&D performing units, which are found in government, in science councils, higher education sector, business sector, and the non-profit sector. So there is a survey that is undertaken annually called the R&D survey, a survey of research and experimental development, which collects data in this regard. It goes around the country every year in these sectors that I mentioned. Simply, it's a lot more questions than these ones that I've listed here, but I've just given examples. For example, we want to find out how much did a particular unit spend on R&D in a given year? What were the sources of funding that R&D? And what human resources were utilized in performing that R&D? There's a set of other questions, but this, at a high level, gives a proper introduction to what is. Then these R&D performing units are identified across all these sectors, and then they respond to this survey. The data on R&D can be disaggregated in various ways by sectors of the economy, that is manufacturing, for example, by provincial profiles to know how much is spent in the Western Cape or Gauteng or Limpopo, by research fields, the domains of research, for example, how much is spent on health-related R&D, by socioeconomic R&D, that is the intended space in which that R&D is used, and also understanding of R&D contribution of state-owned entities as opposed to a private sector funds, R&D, as well as the foreign source of funding and local source of funding. That is a broad outline of the GERD. Now, the composition of R&D performing sectors is shown on the screen. I've already explained a business non-profit sector, government, science councils, and the higher education. And then the GERD GDP indicator. This indicator, GERD as a percentage of GDP, is commonly used measure. It's a measure of R&D intensity in an economy. That is, it expresses gross expenditure on R&D as a percentage of GDP of a national territory or a region in a given period. So gross domestic product, essentially, is a measure of economic activity in a country. It represents the market value of the goods and services produced within the borders of an economy. So the GERD GDP, it's an important indicator that's used across countries to measure the R&D capacity and innovation performance, and it's used benchmarking what is called the knowledge-based activity in an economy. And the countries that have high R&D intensity are generally found to have advanced technological innovation capabilities. Now, we also need to understand the role of government in R&D as opposed to the role of private sector in R&D in a country. That government puts a whole lot of funds into a broad sector called science, technology, and innovation activities, including also activities for knowledge-based work in the ICTs and software development, funding, and all these things. All those things, there is a broader concept called scientific and technological activities, which is a range of activities for generating and diffusing the use of science and technology-related knowledge, and also activities for building what is called S&T capabilities. And the government departments, because of their different roles, they perform different but interrelated roles in this value chain. For example, the Department of Science and Innovation provides leadership in this space in terms of planning what big areas need to be focused on in terms of the direction for science and technology policy, big choices in terms of the missions where R&D investment needs to be made by government to catalyze certain areas of work or breakthrough into places that private sector wouldn't ordinarily start or do, which then creates opportunities for other sectors like private sector and international parties to come on board and invest. That is now DST. But then we find departments, various departments, that actually uses the knowledge or the results of R&D in implementing whatever mandates they are entrusted with. For example, the Department of Transport is more concerned about utilization of the technology that arises from R&D to improve transport systems. So we thought we need to make that understanding, to explain that understanding so that we are clear with the concepts. And the scope of government's role covers a funding for whatever what is called the public research institutions and R&D programs, the modernizing of a research infrastructure, the investment to grow the high-level human capital investment, that is the funding for PhDs and advanced studies, the research chairs, technology transfer activities, the work that we are doing with the National Intellectual Property Management Office, and the specialized facilities such as laboratories and things that are funded by government in general, including also providing incentives to business sector to encourage them to invest more in R&D. We have drawn a baseline data using 2017-18 R&D survey results to inform the modeling or estimation of the required additional investment going forward to reach the target. What we present here in this slide is a trend from 2004 to 2017, which shows that R&D investment, or GERD, in nominal terms, in 2017-18, which is the latest available data that was published in October, in October this year, 2019, was 38.7 billion rand. This is 8.5% an increase from the previous year, 2016. And in real terms, when we take out the effects of inflation over time, that investment is estimated at 25.9 billion rands. What we see in this slide is that although R&D investment in the country has expanded over time, in the more recent years, in real terms, the increases have slowed down. For example, in the year 2013 to 2014, real terms increase was about 8%, whereas from 2016 to 2017, it was only 3.1%. We hope this turns around, and then we have a larger increase. Then in this slide, what we are presenting is the GERD as a percentage of GDP trend over time. What we see is that there was a peak in the year 2006-07 of 0.90. In 2017-18, the rate was at 0.83%, as noted by the committee in our previous presentation. A concern here is that between the year 2014-15 to 2017-18, the reported increases, although we can see these are mathematical improvements, increases because of the calculation, although we see increases from 0.77 to 0.83, that ratio has actually been calculated in an environment where economic growth rate was actually slowing down. So that's not ideal. You want to be achieving increases in R&D investment intensity in a space where the economy is actually growing. But importantly is that R&D, even in times of tough economic environments, has to be kept abreast. Countries need to be investing in R&D because it helps in the upturn down the line. In this slide, Chair, Honorable Chair, we're showing the categories or R&D performing sectors comparing 2006 to 2017-18. What we see here is that although business sector is the main performer of R&D, its role has declined over time. We can compare, and then the university sector, higher education institutions, have shown consistent growth over this time. In business sector was about 56% in 2006, but then in 2017 it was about 41%. Whereas the higher education was 20% in 2006, and then increased to 34% in 2017-18. This has been a trend that we've been reading over these years. It has been going to that direction. The next slide shows the sources of funding, by major sources of funding. What we pick up in this slide, Honorable Chair and members, is that government has become the largest funder of R&D in the country. This is different from the situation before 2008, where business sector was the largest funder of R&D in this country. So we can see, looking at the years 2006-2017, that government has actually expanded its role as a funder, whereas government and business are still the largest funder, business sector has actually reduced its role. We have done preliminary modeling to answer the questions that were asked in this committee, and also the questions that have been asked in the process of discussing the MTSF, medium-term strategic framework. The modeling that we have done is to estimate the required additional investment to achieve the target stated. We have to make certain assumptions in order to do this. We have learned also that whereas we are doing this work here, there's work that in Europe they've been doing over a period of time. We're taking some lessons from them at the EU level. they've got a target of 3% GDP by 2030, and they've been doing these things in specific countries and also at that level of the EU. So we try to learn from the approach that they're following, but taking into account our own circumstances. What we have here, we had to draw some data that we can use as basis for GDP growth. What we have here is the GDP data drawn from Statistics South Africa, which goes up to 2018, reflected by the blue marking. And then from then on, the projections that were drawn from the International Monetary Fund, such projections go up to 2024. And then we use the National Treasury. We also learned that when we look at the various, we look at various sources for projections. National Treasury has actually projected and revised their projections during the mini budget speech 3 weeks ago, and those were quite higher, but then they've been revised downwards. They are more in line with what the IMF and the other independent sources in South Africa were projecting. So we decided to use the IMF numbers as projections. But then again, because they go up to 2024, we then use the MTSF forecast from 2025 to 2030, which are 2.5% and 5.4% of GDP. We asked important questions that we drew from various discussions, including tracking back to say, in 2017-18, noting that at that time the GAR GDP was 0.83%, we asked the question, what would it be if we put 1% to understand what is the investment gap, for example? So we will present that just now. Then the second question we asked, what would it be looking forward in 2024, the GAR GDP at 1.1%? Then we use the World Bank GDP, the IMF GDP focus. That's a mistake there. IMF GDP focus. And what would it be also in 2030? The 1.5% of GDP in 2030. Then we drew certain scenarios. We have scenario one. We'll only concentrate on scenario one today, where we say a no action scenario. We made the following assumptions that if there is no additional funding allocation beyond the inflation adjustments on the current funding trajectory, which is what we are seeing in government in the recent years, there is no significant injection in funding in many places because of the fiscal pressures. That we also assume that conditions for business investment remain unchanged, because we think right now the business investment is subdued, although we hear the commitments that are being made, but in actual terms it has remained subdued. Then the third assumption is the employment of researchers. If it does not increase in any significant way beyond the current trend that we see, because investment in researchers, employment of researchers on its own can be a driver to higher a spending or capacity to spend on R&D. On the other hand, we know that we are quite aware that increase in spending with the same number of people means other things in terms of these numbers, how they mean. That international funding sources would remain hesitant and not change in any significant way compared to what we know in the current trend. And then the sector R&D spending to increase in line with inflation. Baseline of 2017 R&D survey were used to do this, and the inflation forecasts are taken from the IMF. So we use these assumptions to draw scenario one, with a view that we are going to reflect certain points based on this scenario. But what we see is that it's not an option. Something has to be done differently. Khumutso will present on the next slide in terms of the the findings of this model.
Thank you, honorable members. As Godfrey has already indicated, before one can do any modeling, one has to do some assumptions. Obviously, we do need some focus given that we don't have actual data to use. Scenario one, as he indicated, is that is business as usual. Given the fiscal constraints that we are in and the trends as portrayed in the R&D survey in terms of the performance, we assumed scenario one as our base scenario. And I think just to indicate that there are possible other scenarios that could be explored, but for now we are putting forward scenario one, which is the base. Now, now, also what to keep in mind is that the focus here is that we are looking at 1.1% target by 2024, 1.5 target by 2030 in terms of the 2030 in terms of the 2019 white paper, 2024 in terms of the MTSF. And again, we said maybe we also need to look at the 1% as indicated in the NRDS. And graph A there and graph B are going to be showing our results from the modeling that we did. Also important to know is that GDP that has been estimated, as Godfrey has indicated, that the actual data was up to 2018. We used the World Bank data to forecast to 2030. So for JED, we also had to forecast, as we know that the current data that we have is 2017-18 in terms of the R&D survey. So for that, we use the inflation target also from the IMF to focus into 2030. Now that we have both variables, GDP up to 2030 forecasted and JED up to 2030 forecasted, we are good to go in terms of calculating what would be the target as prescribed in the various policy documents. And graph A there shows the actual quantum in rand amounts, and graph B shows the ratio of JED to GDP. We have actuals as well as estimations. In terms of 2017-18, if you look at graph A, we are sitting currently at 39 billion in terms of JED. The orange there is actually the actual, it's not the forecast on 2017-18. But then when you look again, all the blue under graph A is the various targets as has been mentioned before. Now, if we calculate 1% in 2017-18 of GDP, we see that we could have been at around 46 billion instead of 39 billion. So right there we see that already, if you assume things as they are, we are going to have a gap. Now, going into 2024, we see that the target of 1.1%, we could have been at about 58 billion. But then using the focus of the IMF, we see that actually, if things go according to how it has been forecasted, will be about 55 billion. Again, there we see that 2024 will have investment gap. And looking at 2030, again, looking at target of 1.5 of GDP in 2030 as forecasted by the IMF, we see that we should be at about 93 in order to be at 1.5. But in actual terms, we'll be around 71 billion. So again, there we see a gap. And I think also graph B only shows that in terms of JED to GDP estimations, percentages, that currently we are at 0.83, 2017-18, but if we would have been at 1%, in 2024, we would be at, in terms of our scenario, we'd be at 1.04 instead of 1.1%, as well as 2030, we would be at 1.15 instead of 1.5. Now, basically, the two graphs show that we will have that investment gap of about 8 billion in 2017-18, about 3 billion in 2024, and about 21 billion in 2030. Now, we also ask ourselves, okay, if we estimate that 2024 we need about 58 billion, Where will that additional investment come from? Go to the next slide, please. Okay. Where will that additional investment come from? And again here, you need to remember the graphs that Godfrey presented earlier on, the colorful graphs on compositions of the performance of JED by various sectors, as well as the funding of JED by various sectors. So we use the assumptions from the R&D survey in terms of compositions of those various sectors. Just to clarify that, we see that government currently, in terms of 2017-18, in terms of funding, is about 47%, as Godfrey mentioned, and the business is about 42%, as well as foreign about 10, and other local sources 2%. So if you assume those ratios going into 2024 and also 2030, remember we're assuming business as usual, and we're keeping these ratios constant, we see that graph C shows that government will have to fund about 27 billion, while business has to fund about 24 billion. And we can easily compare that to the actuals which are in 2017-18. And in 2030, we'll see that government will have to fund about 43 billion, while business has to fund about 38 billion. And then the other two sectors, as you can see in the graphs. But then we also ask ourselves, who will perform this R&D? Where is the absorption capacity? And we look again in terms of the R&D survey, what are the proportion currently with the latest results? And we see that the latest results shows that, as Godfrey mentioned, that currently business is performing around 41%, while the next highest performer is higher education at about 34%, and the science councils about 16%, government 6%, and then NPO, which is the non-profit sector, about 3%. So again here, we used those scenarios to see how then this additional funding that we have focused at will be performed. And we see that, again here, 2017 is the actuals as from the R&D survey. Going into 2024, the 1.1% target, we see that in terms of performing sectors, we see that business, as the highest performer, will be performing about 24 billion, and followed by the higher education, which is about 20 billion. Now, going to 2030, we see again that the business would have to perform about 38 billion, while the higher education will have to perform about 31, followed by the science councils, etc. But then one needs to ask themselves one question, that if we say that the business must now come and fund this much in terms of this rent billions, or perform this much in terms of this rent billions, it means that more engagement, collaboration is very critical. Collaboration between the government and the business sector is very critical in order to attain this rent billion amount. I think I'll take it.
Thank you. So to conclude, there is an approach recommended going forward. What is actually happening now is that the work that's taking place is building from preceding policies, what has been implemented since the 1996 White Paper on Science and Technology. There is need that this work on the estimation of required investment be closely aligned, which is what the department is doing, aligned to the work of planning implementation of the decadal plan, which the decadal plan will define in more specific detail measure areas to be driven by government in implementing the white paper, the new white paper. There is work unfolding in government of the sector master plans led by the Department of Trade and Industry, which the GCSI is going to be engaging with us, is actually engaging in that process with a view to identify specific areas that are earmarked for R&D and technological innovation for various sectors, which is the potential source for investment. Those are going to be targeted in the way we implement the monitoring tools, such as R&D survey, but also targeted in terms of co-investment or mobilizing investment from government and other sources. There is also a consideration underway of the work that Department of Planning, Monitoring, and Evaluation has completed on the review of government incentives. There are specific recommendations there that have implications for this work, which are being taken into account in the department and supposed to be reflected even more. The next steps and recommendations is that, in summary, this work we presented today captures preliminary work. We have planned as a DSI a series of briefings and consultations with specific actors in the system to enrich this work. And then that work will also focus on developing alternative scenarios beyond this, because what we presented today is saying a no-action scenario. But then we need to start saying, if we want things to be different, what are the scenarios that we need to project and map that back into the plans, the planning of, so what are actions that need to be put in place to achieve that? So developing alternative scenarios is a key aspect of that, including also a recommendation today to the Portfolio Committee, Honorable Chair, to the extent possible to enable briefings and engagement with other portfolio committees on these imperatives that are being presented here. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chair, one thing to conclude in terms of to reinforce a particular issue. The base scenario assumes that both government and the private sector will continue to increase their R&D at an inflation rate. So what we haven't done yet is we haven't put in risks that could change that. As an example, the current allocation letters that government departments have received, in fact, are putting R&D spending at less than inflation. So even the base scenario, which will only get us to 1.05% by 2024, could be lower if the increases in R&D is below inflation, which is more likely to happen. So the first issue I think that's very important for us collectively is to continue the engagement with all social partners, including government, to at least maintain R&D at inflation level increases.
Okay, thank you very much for the presentation, work in progress. I hope members have noted the issues arising there, so we will ask the questions when we're done with all the presentation. Can we get maybe we should break for about 5 minutes so that you set up to get the presentation on the laws, science and technology amendment laws. But before that, I think we're joined by some few people. Maybe if we can just get the introductions. And okay, and probably the apology for coming late as well. If we're expecting you here, but if you're just passing by, it's okay.
Good morning, honorable members. My apology indeed for coming in late. It was because of a delayed flight from Johannesburg. But I managed to be here, and I'm privileged to be here. My name is Tizora Senyalo. I'm from the Department of Science and Technology.
Okay. What do you do there?
I am in the Legal Services Division. My work involves advising the Ministry and the whole department on legal matters.
My designation,
I'm a deputy director.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Are you alone? Who else? Oh, okay.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Lihle Hlophe. I'm a Senior Legal Officer at the Department of Science and Innovation. I'm also sorry for coming late. There was a very long queue at the registration center.
So you also came with the same flight?
No, Your Worship. No, sorry, Honorable Chair. I came with the DDG. Unfortunately, she had to leave me at the registration entrance.
Okay. Night as a slip of the tongue. Honorable Chair, very far from being the... Okay, madam.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Happy Mlife. I'm responsible for governance at the Department of Science and Innovation, which is basically oversight of entities. I'm also apologizing, the queue is very long at the visitor center. Thank you.
You are responsible for governance. Okay, so what's your designation?
It's director.
I'm sure you're embarrassed to arrive late and you find your senior sitting down. So in future, please try to arrive very early. You come early, find that your boss is sitting down, the minister is here, the DDGs, and you guys just walk in late. I'm sure they also went through what you went through in terms of registration and stuff. So please, next time, if you are late, maybe you must just go back, take the flight, fly back to home, and not come here, because we don't appreciate that. Okay, let's break and then let's get people to set up. 5 minutes, we're back. Okay, let's take our seats. Okay, the team that will be taking us through the bill, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, maybe in starting my presentation, I should give a bit of a background of the process that we had gone through previously. That we had gone through the bill with the committee, the previous committee, and we had gone through all the clauses and debated all the clauses, and there was a proposal from the committee on which clauses to continue with, which clauses to change, and that process was concluded. So the chairperson, I think you may guide us to say as to in the would we take it from there as the process, or do we still have to go back to take through the committee on all the clauses that we had originally proposed. But the presentation currently is introducing what the bill is about and why we are presenting, we are proposing the amendments that we are proposing as a department. How this came about, it was us realizing that there were inconsistencies that we needed to harmonize in all the bills of all the entities that report to our minister. And I think I may also mention that this process does not include the NRS Act, because as we started this Act, there was a process of amending the NRS Act. And in this process, we ensured that all the provisions that affect governance of the entity are taken care of in the NRS Act and are the same as what we are proposing here. And I think as if we get an opportunity to go through clause by clause, we'll identify those clauses that we had already concluded with the NRF and that would like to harmonize with this bill, with the other acts, with the other entities as well. So as I've indicated, and also the Deputy Minister indicated earlier on, that the key problem that we're trying to solve here is harmonizing the governance of the entity, so that one entity doesn't have a process that says consult with the minister, another entity has a process that says consult after or appoint after you have consulted with the minister. So we've identified all those clauses that needed to be harmonized, and in that process we identified clauses that we thought needed to be included in the new bill, and also identified clauses that we needed to remove from the bill, which we will present to the committee when it's necessary and the time to do that. In the presentation, as I said, Chairperson, that we will be looking at what are the problems, and we've kind of did a high level statements that talk to the proposed amendments. And also
Which slide are you on?
I'm on slide, the content slide. It's the introduction. Slide 2.
The introduction?
Yes.
Are you still on introduction?
Yes. I'm going to go first. I just needed to give you the background.
it should be in your pack. Just go through your pack.
Yeah.
You don't have.
Let's see.
There's a.
This is the slide I'm asking. Content.
I have got it in my pack. You don't have. Okay, let's just check. Some more copies there. Tandukola was taking a nap there. So late in the morning. Let's try to be quick, ne?
Okay.
Yeah, don't take an unnecessary long time on the
Okay.
I mean, this is just straightforward things.
Okay.
Just go to the actual issues.
Okay. Chairperson, can I therefore go to slide that talks on the objectives of the bill? This is slide 6.
Yeah.
Slide 6. Okay.
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 So are we sorted, members? Are we fine now? Okay.
Okay. Okay, like I said, the objectives of the bill are to harmonize the laws that are governing our entities. The key things that we found glaringly inconsistent with, amongst the other the legislations that we are amending here is one of the first one is around the remuneration and allowances. We found that there were inconsistencies and we'd like to harmonize that. And the next one was around the termination of membership of boards. The various inconsistencies around that, the processes of appointment of the chief executives of officers of the entities and their condition of appointment or secondment of the employees in the entities as well by the board and the CEO. We also identified inconsistencies in the delegation of powers by the board, and we thought that needs to be in writing. We need to have a process that puts that in writing. And also we identified the issues around the termination of membership of boards and committee members and councils. Also identified there was an issue around the clarification in terms of disqualifying members from becoming members of the board or council, and we had to deal with that as well. And also to provide another clause on appointment of external persons to committees of boards and councils. And also, as I've indicated, also we had to deal with the determination of the remuneration, and we had to align that to what Treasury is, the Treasury directives are stipulating in terms of that. Now, with the proposed amendments, obviously these proposed amendments will talk to those objectives of the bill. Is also, first one, it was around the consultation with the minister in terms of the appointment of CEOs. In some entities, there was a consultation. In some, it was a consultation after the appointment. And we realized that in some cases, there's a chance that a CEO may be appointed without the minister knowing that there's a CEO appointed. And also, there was a limitation that we thought it was a governance issue in terms of the period that the CEOs can serve as CEOs in the entities, and we are proposing a limited period of time that just for good governance and good practice in the entities. And we also thought that there should be a procedural way of dealing with meetings and minutes and how they are constituted and the numbers of the meetings, just to make sure that they are consistent in all the entities, and also the procedures in the convening of the boards or councils. And also we thought that there was no provision for members in some acts on the disclosure of interests in the business or the entities, so we needed to harmonize that so that everybody is requested to disclose whatever interest that they may have in the business of the entities. And also the circumstances around the voting of the boards and council meetings, there was no provision in some acts in terms of how that should be conducted. And we also thought that we need to deal with the issues of somewhere where decisions may need to be invalidated as to what process therefore needs to be followed in dealing with that. And we had to provide for the appointment of and secondment of employees in entities, how the CEOs should deal with that, and what would be the board's involvement, if necessary. And then in some of the acts, we realized that there were provisions that were contradicting the PFMA. and we thought that let's remove anything that would contradict any other law, particularly the PFMA. So we proposed clauses that should be removed in some of the acts to facilitate that. We also proposed a process in terms of whether should entities be liquidated, what should happen, and it should be consistent with all the entities. And also, we also thought that the making of regulations, the minister's consultation with the board should happen, and at what in what manner should it happen, and who should be consulted first, and what agreement should be there before the regulations are met, are made that would support the acts that applies to those entities. We also also wanted to make the delegation of functions formal in terms of writing, so we put a clause in with regards to that. And also, we also wanted to provide requirements for the performance of functions by the entities outside the Republic, because we thought sometimes some agreements between our entities and other countries may contradict the relations that the country may have with that particular country may have with our country. And all the matters also, again, related to that. And then the next slide, Chairperson, it's a snapshot of an example of what acts are being amended, addressing what gaps, and what amendments, therefore, how the act would look like when amended, and what would be the benefit of that act. The first one, for an example, is that the department may be unaware of the appointment of the CEO of the entity, and therefore we inserted a provision that the minister, there must be a consultation with the minister. And the column second last from the right is how we propose that the amendment should be like in the bill. And the last column is the benefit is that the department won't not know when the CEO is appointed in the entity. And we have the second example. This one is about the disclosure that I talked about of interest, of the conflict of interest by the members. And the benefit to that is that it's a good corporate governance practice that we are promoting by this by this provision of this clause. And that's how the clause would look like as proposed in the bill. And the third example is the one I talked about, the PFMA, that in certain provisions, in certain acts, there are provisions that are contrary to the PFMA, and here there's no provision because we're removing those clauses, so there's no proposed clause. We're removing the clauses that exist that contradict the PFMA, so the outcome is that there would not be any contradiction of any laws within the country. Chairperson, in terms of the consultation, we have consulted all stakeholders that needed to be consulted and all entities that needed to be consulted. We also consulted with the Chief State Law Advisors. And they have given us a go-ahead that the bill is constitutional and compliant. And we've also, the Department of Planning and Monitoring, Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation exempted the application of the SEAS process in respect of the bill.
What is the SEAS?
It's the socio-economic impact assessment process where you have to consult. Yeah. So that process didn't happen. And then in the consultation process, Chairperson, there were two comments. The bill was open for 60 days as required, and we also put it in our website for the public to be able to view it and make comments on it. And we received two comments, one from TIA and the other one from the Western Cape government, and we have processed those comments that were given to us. Some comments we accepted their recommendations, some we couldn't accept, but we gave reasons why we couldn't accept those. And if need be to discuss with the committee, we can be able to do that, give the information to the committee. So those are the only two organizations that gave comments and responded to them. Thank you, Chairperson. I think that's the end of the presentation.
Okay, thank you very much. That was brief. It's not a detailed piece of legislation, just correcting there and there. So thank you very much. Members are taking note. For me, it's quite a straightforward. So the legislation was processed in the last parliament, the fifth parliament.
Chairperson, at the National Assembly side. Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you. Can we get the last presentation on the convention? You do have copies of the convention, members? All right, thank you.
Good. Thank you, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members. I'm going to be presenting on the agreement between the Republic of South Africa and the International Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology. These relate to the agreements that have been recently signed, even though we have been members of the ICGB now for quite some time. It's going to be a very brief presentation, so I'm not going to go to the outline. I'm just going to go straight to the introduction. Now, the International Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology is an intergovernmental organization that was initially established as a special project of UNIDO. And we've got in it about 46 state-of-the-art laboratories, and these laboratories are primarily at the headquarters in Trieste, Italy, and then also in the center, which is based in Delhi. And the third center, which is based in Cape Town. There are other components that are scattered all over the world, but they are basically smaller laboratories, and they are not, they don't qualify really to be called components. So the centers are generally funded by the membership fees that are paid. However, over the past couple of years, the host of the components have been the main funders of the components they are hosting. For example, you find that India is the primary funder for the Delhi component, and we are, as the Department of Science and Innovation, providing the bulk of the funding for the Cape Town component, with a little bit of money coming in from other international partners, including philanthropic organizations. Now, this is really just a snapshot of how the laboratories look, and as you can see, the Delhi is quite a huge facility. It's got about 25 research groups, while Trieste in Italy has got 18 research groups. We have only got 3 research groups. Actually, the third one was only established quite recently. And in terms of the space, we are actually hosted at the University of Cape Town, whereas the rest are actually standalone research facilities. So ours is really a facility within a facility at the University of Cape Town. And this is really just to indicate what sort of research groups we have in various of the components. The Cape Town component has a focus on cancer genomics, cytokines and diseases, as well as now the latest addition on biopesticides. And we are working on adding
two more activities that are mainly in on the side of commercialization of products. So there are a number of instruments of action that the ICGB uses. One of them is the training for students and researchers, whether it's PhD or postdoctoral students. And these are mainly done and hosted at the Trieste component. But then there are also various exchange programs amongst the components themselves. So you find that there are opportunities that are availed for researchers and students to be at Delhi or to be at the Cape Town component. And the Cape Town component is quite crucial in the sense that it is also the main center for the African continent. So the work that is being done here also needs to look at how to accommodate and train researchers from the African continent. The ICGB also organizes international meetings and courses and workshops, and this is quite crucial because the speed with which the developments are in the area of biotechnology is such that you cannot just teach them in a normal pedagogic process of getting people get their degrees. So you need to have a number of tailor-made courses as you go. There are also competitive research grants where member countries can actually apply. And there are always conditions when these grants are offered, is that if a grant is offered for a researcher from the African continent to study abroad, that there must be a commitment that such a researcher will then go back to their respective countries to build the system in their countries. And then there is provision of technical assistance and capacity enhancement in regulation of biotechnology and its products. And this is going to become a very big area of work now, given that the advent of the fourth industrial revolution is such that the convergence of technologies is seeing a whole range of newer products, especially bioproducts. And we need to build capabilities in terms of regulation and policies, especially in the African continent, so that when biotechnology-based products are launched into the market, then people are sure that there has been proper regulation to make sure that people are safe when they utilize such products. And then there is an element of transferring of know-how to industry for the production of biologics and diagnostics. And I'll speak a little bit about biologics in the upcoming slides. So one of the things that we have decided to focus on around the ICGB is that there has been a lot of narrative around biotechnology. And we have figured that it is important that we start to have awareness-raising programs so that students, researchers, and actually communities can be made aware of the real issues and the concerns to avoid a situation where there is rumor and fake news that actually get exchanged around what biotechnology products are like and what they do. So we have a number of initiatives, including our Science Week events, various outreaches that we have with our science advancement programs, just making sure that we raise awareness of biotechnology. We also have started to incorporate this awareness session on a number of bio-based conferences that we have, including the one of the big conferences called the Bio-Africa Convention. Now, in terms of the areas that we are basically focusing on is biosafety. Now, biosafety is making people aware of the safety and precautionary issues around biotechnology products. And then the biosimilars is really where we're looking at alternative medicines. Biosimilars are medicines that are similar to the typical drugs that are sold in the market, but these are manufactured using bio-based processes, and the process of manufacturing is much cheaper and is quite quicker to get them into the market than the normal drugs. So this is one area where we are beginning to invest a lot of funding to make sure that we can develop biosimilars, especially for the problematic diseases that we're dealing with in the developing world. So we are working to look at expanding the various program focus for the Cape Town component. And as I've mentioned, we're looking now at how we can create linkages with other existing initiatives. South Africa currently hosts the SANBio, which is a regional bio innovation center for the African Union for the SADC region. So we want to also look at how do we establish synergies between the Cape Town ICGB component and SANBio. But most critically, there is a lot of IP that has been generated at the ICGB, which because of us being members, we have access to. And now we want to begin to look at the whole IP portfolio and see which one can we actually harvest for the benefit of South Africa and for the African continent. And this is looking at vaccines, technology, biosimilars, and generics. So we have now some advanced engagements in that regard, and we're hoping that we'll soon be working with the private sector to establish some facilities to manufacture biosimilars locally. So the host country agreement, after many years of engagement, was ultimately signed in March this year. And it has gone through the various processes, including National Assembly and the Council of Provinces. Now, in terms of the challenges that we have had with regards to the delayed agreement signing, one of them is a problem that doesn't only apply to the ICGB, but many other international entities that we host as a country, where you find that there are demands that people who work in them shouldn't pay taxes. And according to our own laws, South Africans that are employed must pay taxes. So we have really been unable to deal with this matter. But ultimately, we have agreed that while we are trying to resolve this issue, we will just make sure that anybody who is employed as a South African in these entities will be continuing to pay their taxes, while through the relevant executive authorities around National Treasury leadership, that we can see how this is resolved. It does impact, for example, our hosting of the Pan-African University of Space Science as well, and other international entities. So the solution is not being found only for the ICGB, but for other entities that are affected similarly. So that's basically it in terms of this particular issue of the ICGB. We are seeing a lot of possibilities for not only South Africa but for the continent by us hosting this one of the three components globally around biotechnology. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation of the convention. It's also straightforward as I see it. The international agreement that facilitates scientific cooperation. Okay, honorable members, those are the three presentations. So we started with the R&D, the scenarios that were presented to increase the level of investment in R&D. And then we had the laws, now the convention. So I think this was just straightforward things. I see members don't have anything to raise. Okay, I see four hands. Honorable Mananiso. Mamsbia, Honorable Boshoff, Honorable Ngobo, Honorable Mkasha. And Honorable Lizia, not that you want to come in? Okay, in that order.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Let me firstly start by welcoming all the reports. On the first one of estimation of R&D, I just want to check with the members here that have you assumed a scenario where government invest more than business? Because from my perspective of the ANC, at times people feel skeptical when they see the more chunk coming from business or private sectors rather than government. Because at some point, we don't want to see ourselves being captured by other people. And we believe that the R&D is one of the base that as government of the ANC, you must invest more rather than business. And that's what I want to check. If have you actually assessed that particular scenario, the possibilities of it and the risk factors of it? I pass on this one of R&D. And the other thing that I wanted to check just to get clarity, I know that it was presented, issues of what is the plan that you have to ensure that you increase the, is it GERD or GERD? Yeah. What are the measures that are there that you have put in place so that you're able to increase, as you're saying, that it goes at the slower pace? And then on the one of the convention, as this particular, as this committee, I think one of the things that we have emphasized on is that it is nice to see pictures and we get confidence that really as this sector we're doing our part, more especially, you know, as South Africa, that we are able to do such big things. I want to check through with Deputy Minister if we can go for an oversight. You see, these things we must see, touch and feel in terms of what is it that is happening. Yeah,
there are three sides. Which one? The one in Italy.
Okay. Yeah. Through DM, I just want to check the possibility of that one, so that when we speak boldly, so that we are capable in terms of this STI, we are able to make examples like the presenters were doing that. And then on the issue of awareness, every time when the STI is presenting, your last part, you write with all these indigenous languages. I want to check how far are you to ensure that these smart presentations are able to be narrated as well with African languages. Because you see this 4IR, if you don't understand a little bit of the content, you seek to lose the big chunk of the development of the 4IR. So I want to check how far are you in terms of translating to the indigenous languages. Lastly, Chairperson, with regards to the laws amendment bills, I think we must applaud the team. They have done their part. As the ANC, we always emphasize issue of professionalizing the public sector. And it comes clear here in terms of what is it that you do. As this committee, we are shocked that some of the people who are members of other entities as board members, others they have matric, you know, and with a matric person, you would have limited knowledge, experience, and skills. So at least we can see that with whatever that you have done, you really adhere and listen to the governing part in terms of what is it that they want to achieve. The issue of limitation of term of office as well, it is one of the things that you did well on, because these people, when you leave them to be leading forever, they seek to be the furniture and bulldoze everybody, and then they drag service delivery. So well done, team. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ma'am Spia.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thanks for my presentation. Chairperson, and page, no, I don't know the page, but the slide, which shows the GDP. Hi, it was bad. 2011, 12, 13, 14. What was the cause? Please, as present. Was declining. What was the cause of too much decline? Say Lulala. Next. You are saying Uma proposed amendments that the department was not unaware about appointment of the CEO. Okay, you are amending. And the board shall, in consultation with the minister. Do you mean, as we are talking now, you don't consult the minister to appoint a CEO? I'm not clear. How to casa. How do you appoint a CEO? Thanks, ma'am.
Okay, thanks, Ma'am Sphere. Honorable Boshoff.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure there's a whole concept of research and development which we want to raise to 1.5%. Or I see we mention an aspirational goal or something like that. It seems to me a little bit like a dream or a prayer, an aspirational goal. But somewhere in one of the documents, which I couldn't lay my hands on again, there was mention was made of a tax incentive act or bill or something for tax incentive, and is the idea to draw in more investment from the private sector by incentivizing research and development, and are we going to be informed on that at another stage? When I prepared, I actually expected that to be in the law amendment, but this was more about governance issues, which I would just like to commend. It seems to me to be very well thought through. And then the other thing I just want to ask on this thing with a long name, where is it now? The convention. Is this convention going to be ICGEB? I understand that it's a branch of an international institution. Is it going to account to the department or to the committee a little bit like an entity? Or how would its functioning and this department's oversight over it compare with an entity like, well, any of the others? Thank you.
Okay, Honourable Ngozi.
Thank you very much to you, Chairperson, and we welcome the presentations. Thank you very much. My question is it relates to the expectations which the department has that the private sector at the end will be contributing more in terms of those projections. Is a plan already in existence in terms of how you will be conversing support of business to achieve those targets? And in actual fact, is there anything concrete now as we speak? That's the question on the R&D. Then the next one, Chairperson, it's in relation to the awareness. The awareness, it seems to me that a lot will have to be done. Science, we're talking about the fourth industrial revolution as being upon us, and there is definitely a lot that needs to be done. I just wanted to very briefly hear whether there are other measures other than what I can see there, which talks about the showcasing, and you're making an example of science and the city. Just a short question. Biosimilar, is that talking about the generics? I just wanted to check on those few, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Litzia.
Thank you very much, Chair. Also, let me acknowledge the presentations. Maybe start on a point Honorable Mananis was saying of in oversight. I think, Deputy Minister, this might maybe be relevant to you. maybe if we can do oversight at here at the headquarters in Italy, the 18 research groups, so that we see why we have three and they've got 18. maybe the department can assume responsibility of costs there. But on a serious note, I'll only speak on one issue, Chair, on the first presentation. On the they said they made a no action scenario, the scenario that you presented, it's an assumption based scenario taken from the data you have of 2017-18. the DDG and Dr. Patel covered me on the risk part because I wanted to check. Your scenario looked like does not take into cognizance the existence of risks. But I want to check what other scenarios, I know that you have not done them, but what other scenarios can you do based on this thing? And what I'm interested to see the outcomes of other scenarios. Rightfully so, because of fiscal constraints. As things stand, government is your highest contributor in terms of funding. If constraints becomes worse, as you said, in 2030, in order for us to reach the 1.5, you'll need almost 60% or so, 50-something, of government funding. What happens if government can't get there? Does it mean we'll not reach the target of 1.5 in 2020? I'm trying to provoke your mind to check other scenarios that you can bring into play. Obviously, possibly working with other entities in the department. Lastly, I think Honorable Joseph Boshoff covered me. Is this the last one? Is it the genetic engineering? What? Will it operate as an entity in the department, or will it be something else there? Maybe an entity like your innovation. Is it NIA, National Innovation Agency, or something? And maybe clarify us on that part so that we're able to at least to understand what we're doing there. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Mkhatshwa.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, and apologies for arriving late. Just to catch on from what the Honourable Letsia was speaking to. Once you've explained, because maybe I'm jumping the gun, but once you've explained how the convention will operate from the questions that he has asked, how do you intend on robbing students and researchers from institutions that don't have proximity to UCT? So I'm assuming that often, if you look at the CSIR, for example, many of their students come from the University of Pretoria, and I don't believe that's by default. It's because of the proximity that those students have to the CSIR. Therefore, being presumptuous, the students at UCT or the researchers at UCT would have proximity to the Africa component of the convention. How do we broaden that so that students from different institutions can have access to it, onto the initiatives that take place there, particularly those from historically disadvantaged institutions? And then another component that's missing is us understanding the demographics of the participants within the convention, your researchers. How many women, how many men, their race profile, their racial profile, their age. And then another question that I have is how will, if it's not already doing work in terms of building the community around it, but how does the convention go beyond just the research that you have to do that does contribute to the development of the country, but just those sort of social, tangible, plowing back initiatives into the community? Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. There you have questions. Some small addition from myself. We postponed a briefing on the decadal plan very early during when we started with our term as a portfolio committee. We're told that the decadal plan will be ready and approved through all the processes latest October as part of implementation of the white policy on science, technology, and innovation. So we had to postpone that because we're told that it's not yet ready. Now, how far are we with that plan? Because I guess that's a plan that will be an overarching policy perspective on some of the issues, including the R&D part, will have to be reflected on that plan as well. So how far are we, and what's the reason for the delay in getting the decadal plan approved by cabinet, and after which we will then be briefed? Now, when I look at the slide, and I think it's consistent with our previous observations as a committee, that it does appear that business is not really coming to the party in a big way in terms of investing. And I see on this slide over a 10-year period, the investment from business has declined from 44.8 to 41.5 on research and development. I don't know what the scenarios, because it looks like it's these are the initial thoughts in terms of ratcheting up the levels of investment. So I don't know what are some of the assumptions that we are making around this, because if business continues or business contribution continue to decline, the country will not be able to achieve the target that we have set ourselves. One of the proposals that you are presenting here is for us to engage with the other committees as part of awareness, but also to check what other contributions from the other departments and sectors could be. What are your thinking around sort of clawing back the part of business to invest? Generally, I think, as I said in the past, there is an investment strike by business, especially big business, which is sitting with massive reserves that could be used for investment. Investment to grow the levels of economic growth, but also to create employment. And those reserves are sitting there, which is a challenge that we are facing as a country. And when you see, look at this, you can see that posture which is still here on investment of on R&D. So what are some of the proposals, the thinking around this particular aspect? The rest of the issues, I think it's fine. The convention looks like it's a straight forward proposal together with the amendment laws. I think with the proposal on the amendment of this laws, I don't know why has it taken so much time to realize that there is a need for uniformity around the governance practices in some of the entities that reports to the Department of Science and Innovation or Science and Technology. Because you say that there's been different practices, even the appointment of CEOs and the remunerations, delegations, and all of that. But it's something that is accepted, and I think as a committee we must, if there's no objection, we must approve this thing so that we take it through Parliament, through the National Assembly, of course. Okay. So who's going to start? DDG? On R&D. The DDG presented on R&D.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Honourable Members, for the question. Let me start with the comment that you made about business and the investment strike and the inability to invest. The process that is now in place by DTIC, led by the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition, The process that is being led by the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition around the sector master plans and the process led by the presidency with the investment envoys is something that the DSI is locking into quite explicitly, because when you look at R&D investment in business, you need to look at it sector by sector. The key subsectors, not only at the sector level. So in terms of the subsector level, the main reasons for decline, if the manufacturing and the mining, and I'll ask Godfrey and them to confirm if my analysis is entirely correct, but if manufacturing and mining had to maintain their share, they've been in a general decline, those sectors, then the picture might have looked very differently. Included in the business portion is the state-owned entities. The state-owned entities are not a different sector. When we look at R&D spending in the state-owned entities, they counted within the private sector funding. So what's been happening in the private sector is that the banking sector, the services sector, have maintained their investments. Not a necessary problem, and they've maintained their investments mainly because they have to remain competitive. If they don't invest, you know, they'll be taken over by other banks, etc. Manufacturing and mining has decreased, and the state-owned entities have been decreased. So the strategy we're adopting is, and Bonene and I were just talking before we have here, we are mobilizing to be very, very effective and present in the master sector plan processes. Because unless you're part of those conversations around each sector, in the leather sector, in textiles, etc., so that we can then start injecting, and we have managed to do this. We were part of workshops where we said one of the aspects that have to be looked at as part of the sector plans is what has been happening with R&D, what has been happening with technology, etc. So we're hoping that the kind of credibility that is built up on that process, which will unlock hard investment into factories, etc., will also translate into increased investment in R&D. We have value propositions that we can offer to the private sector because we have now models where government and industry have come together to jointly invest in R&D and technology development. As an example, people are aware of, and I'm hoping that the Portfolio Committee would make time to visit the Mandela Mining Precinct, but the Mandela Mining Precinct is an attempt by government and industry to jointly identify what is required to grow that sector for the mining industry to invest in particular R&D, for us to invest in particular issues. We have the very successful Sector Innovation Fund model, which we want to grow. We have other platforms like the wheat breeding platform, etc. So that's one way in which we want to increase private sector investment, is through these partnerships, building it on the master plans, etc. The second strategy is the R&D tax incentives. At the moment, the R&D tax incentives are there. It's something that is a generic instrument. We're busy evaluating its impact, its design, and look at where we take it forward, because the incentive comes to an end in 2022. Mm-hmm. So as part of that process, we would want to be able to look at it. The third area to increase the share of the private sector investment is we have to relook at the contribution of state-owned entities. Someone asked the question about what accounted for some of the decrease. Some of the decrease is because the private sector had no confidence in the economy, were not increasing it. But other big contributions was that some big government-funded programs came to an end. For example, the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor, there was a lot of R&D in that program, was stopped, and we didn't take that funding and use it for other R&D purposes. So that is kind of, so it was a combination of the financial crisis in 2008, it was the PBMR coming to an end, et cetera, that accounted for that decline. And we're also growing a bit faster than we were in the last few years. As Godfrey had indicated, we see increases in the GERD ratio, but actually it's a false increase, because economic growth has been so slow that it shows up as an increase. If our economy was growing faster, it might still be flat, a flat line. So I hope I've talked about the first question about business investing more, etc. I just want to add one final point around business and government and their respective shares. All successful economies have shown that it's a partnership. There are certain things that the business sector won't invest in because it doesn't make sense for them to invest in, for example, fundamental science, etc. There are other areas that it doesn't make sense for government to invest in. Industries, businesses must invest to keep themselves competitive. They need to be doing new things, etc. And then there's a big space between the two where there's big opportunities for governments and private sectors to work together. Successful economies, whether it's Korea or whatever, have really focused a big component of their efforts around creating these partnerships, and this now has been institutionalized in the white paper. The new white paper has a much more stronger focus on us working together with business. So, for example, the Mandela Mining Precinct, the Wheat Breeding Platform, the SIFs. Those are ways in which I think we need 10 times more of those kinds of initiatives than we currently have now, because it works for business, it works for us, it works for the economy, it works for South Africa. So I've talked about the decline. In terms of the strategies, so yes, the key point to make, Chair and other members, is that it's not just about the modeling work that Motso can do, and she will do this very well. It does require the building of a social compact. To increase R&D, you need a lot of conversations with people. You need to understand why certain people are not investing, what will it take to invest, how can you encourage them. And the department has geared itself. Poneni and I spend a lot more of our time now, because we work with other government departments, spending a lot more time with other government departments to try to understand. As an example, I'm in discussions with the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs to say, if we have something like the Municipal Infrastructure Grant, which is 26 billion rands, how can we use that Municipal Infrastructure Grant for a lot more innovation. We are gaining traction. If we are going to do the national health insurance and we need to invest in the technology and the R&D, can we have a discussion? Bonenni has been very successful in working with our Department of Health counterparts to look at how is it that we can use our own R&D, for example, to develop our diagnostic. So this is not an easy process. It requires a lot of legwork, a lot of discussions, a lot of engagements with people, because what you have to do is you have to change everyone's mindsets to be able to see that R&D is the case. I am a lot more confident in the last year than I've been for the past 20 years. I think all government departments have acknowledged that R&D is important in the context of a fourth industrial revolution and that they need to invest more. What they're not able to do is say, what do we have to decrease in order to invest in others? Because Treasury has said, your total budget is not going to increase. So in a way, they have to shift from one program to another. And we are trying to find ways in which they can shift to one program and another, which doesn't compromise that program, but increases R&D. So the example I gave about the municipal infrastructure grant, if you just set aside even a couple of percent, 2-3% of the municipal infrastructure grant, you can unlock a lot of R&D investment, and then we can work with them to be able to do this. Similarly with the private sector, it's a lot of engagement with individual sectors. Sector by sector, we need to engage with it, because the sugar industry is very different from the mining industry, is very different from the banking sector, etc. So I hope that I've been able to indicate this. So to conclude, the different scenarios that we are planning to build will come about once we've started having engagements. And if we sit with health or with COCTA or with whatever else and they show an interest, we can then start building that into the scenario to say, if we take so much percentage from the municipal infrastructure grant, Kumotso will be able to then say what will be the impact on the large number. I'm not too sure if Godfrey and Kumotso want to add on anything else before we hand over to colleagues to address the other questions.
Thank you. I think most of the issues have been covered. Maybe to just emphasize the issue that government investment has a particular role in all this, and the private sector investment has a different, maybe related role to government investment. So for purposes of private sector, I think adding to what was said, there is a need for a continuous engagement, because circumstances in which they make decisions and the factors that impact on those decisions change from time to time. So from the policymaker's point of view or policy implementers, we need to have a program for continuous engaging with the private sector to understand what is it that's influencing their decisions now to invest or not invest, to invest in A and not B, and do appropriate adjustments in terms of what it to be done. What are their intentions going forward, I think. So this tool that we use to measure R&D, the R&D survey, and the engagement that the department has with the private sector on particularly on the R&D tax incentive, it gives us the space to, as a department, to continually engage with those actors in the private sector as such. I think the other issue that I may need to be brought up in addition to what was said is the issue of uptake of locally developed technologies, and in particular procurement practices, in terms of how does procurement practices stimulate demand for local technologies, whether colleagues in government do take time to understand before buying or procuring something from elsewhere, whether they take time to understand what the viable technologies are available locally. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the things that may be put in place. But then the points that we made regarding the scenarios, we will take them on board as we build alternative scenarios going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to take the questions regarding the issue of the ICJB. Firstly, the question around the oversight. I think it's probably one area where if a decision has been taken to do that, we'll be able to support that. And where they become useful is that when you walk into ICJB Trieste, what they have is effectively pilot manufacturing facilities where they are manufacturing products and they are generating income. So whether you talk about new biologics, as I mentioned, or whether you're talking things like insulin, which we are trying to also look at bringing across, because we've got a big problem around diabetes that is actually in our country. So if we sort of have those innovations, bring them here, that's quite useful. So just to really compare these facilities, you'll see that both Italy and Delhi, they have been very successful in taking the various innovations to the market, Delhi specifically around agriculture. So a whole lot of their new varieties that they launched to grow would have come out of the ICGB component. Then the issue around oversight. So we provide funding, and then there's also other funding that comes through. So there's two levels of accounting that happens. One of them is every year we have the Board of Governors meeting of the ICGB, which involves all the relevant governments, and then the research groups go and account. And those reports are the same reports that we use as a department to look at whether the centers are progressing and making the impact that we want them to do. So we really do that level of accounting. Then the issues of biosimilars, whether they are generics or not. Now, the biosimilars are basically medical products that are based not just on the chemistry as the typical drugs would be. So what you would have when you consume a drug is a very small molecule which is covered in what you call a tablet. So basically the bulk of what you're consuming when you eat a tablet is nothing but just stabilizers. And a very small component of that is the actual active pharmaceutical ingredient. Now, a biosimilar is a much bigger molecule. Based on how your body works and the understanding of the kind of proteins that then regulate your healing process and the disease, and they are therefore being looked at as more promising and more user-friendly remedies when it comes to medicines. So that's really why we are also looking more into the utility of biosimilars. And as you might know, we now talk about the role of genetics in dealing with aspects such as your cancers, etc. So that is really drawing from that angle. Whereas generics will probably be the patent had expired, and now anybody can actually, if you got the know-how, you can just go and manufacture the same drug without having to deal with issues of IP. Honorable member, the issue around students, and I think you're quite spot on in terms of if you don't actually look at managing this process, you end up having a center being at UCT and then it appearing as if it is a UCT center. And that has really been something that we have had a lot of engagement with the component on. So what we then do is, in terms of the attraction of students, calls are made broadly so that students can actually be coming from all parts of the world, not only just all parts of the country. So you have all parts of the country and all parts of the world, because you have students that may be coming from South America, from everywhere in the world. But it is really our responsibility as a department to really push for the transformative agenda. Hence, we keep engaging the center in terms of how they are meeting such. Now, one of the ways that we are looking at dealing with that now is that, as you have seen on the previous slide, the focus has mainly been around health, and we're now bringing on board the aspect of agriculture, which we have found has been more attractive even to the rest of the African continent. So we're beginning to see a number of learners that are coming from other parts of the country and also other parts of the continent that are attracted in agricultural-based innovations. So it is a problem that we cannot rest on our laurel and say it will sort itself. So we keep setting those targets. In terms of plowing back, there are a number of initiatives that we have in place. One of them, as I've indicated, that the ICGB is really some kind of a micro-manufacturing environment. We have now started a program of distributing what we call the $1 microscopes. So these are very, these are sort of paper-based microscopes, which we now are distributing in various schools. So students can play around with. They are cheap, as I said, $1, but we're distributing them for free. Then students can actually play around and start to see when we are being taught about a cell. This is how a cell looks like. They can go and pick up their own water in the pond and begin to play around with it. So we're finding that it is really exciting students to begin to have that appreciation of science. It's one of the initiatives. Many others are in the form of outreaches where we let people know about what genetic engineering is, what are the sort of things to be aware of when we're dealing with the genetically modified organisms. So those are outreach programs that we hope are going to help us attract students into the sciences. Then the last issue around the narration in other languages, Honourable Member. We have the science awareness and engagement programs that are targeted at learners in all provinces, and we basically use our extension of the science centers in various provinces. And I think, as far as I'm aware, all the provinces do have the worst case scenario is that the province will have one, but a number of provinces will have more than one. And we use this as the center where the learners can actually come together, and we then engage with them in various languages that they are comfortable with, of course, mainly English, but then that regional language, if we are in that particular province, is then becomes one of the languages that is compulsory in terms of engagement. We have not reached a stage where our actual documentation are translated in those languages, but our outreach programs are very much in a way that they cater for all the relevant languages. Thanks.
Chair, I would like to add to the R&D investment discussion. As they have mentioned, I think in terms of the government side, we really need to know how to work with the sectoral research and innovation plan, as the DDG has mentioned. And one of the things that we could do is that we need to capitalize on existing strategies or projects, and also look into the future in terms of identify future technologies, maybe by the use of foresight, that we can pick up and then to know that these are the technologies that are needed in the future. And in terms of the private sector, I think it's critical that that collaboration be enhanced. It is currently existing, but it could be enhanced. And one of the things that we looked at in terms of the desktop study is that there are various issues that the business are taking into consideration when they are discussing in terms of their strategies to invest in R&D, and there's no one size fits all. So it's diverse issues. So a whole lot of factors need to be taken into consideration. And what we could pick up just from the desktop study is that issues of firms being associated to some form of affiliation, like DDG mentioned, the mining present, those are the kind of things that help the firms to know that, no, the risk will be lower because they're now belonging to a certain association. Issues of collaboration of businesses with the universities. And on top of that, proximity of those universities to the businesses are critical. And the DDG also mentioned the issue of infrastructure. I won't all repeat on that. And the issue on HCD, critical skills are needed in order to unpack how to increase the investment. And also public policies, they've mentioned the issue of tax incentives, but also need to look at other non-financial incentives that the business can be encouraged in terms of increasing the investment. And then there are also issues of what are the awareness in terms of innovation, both in the business community and in the general public. I think that has also been touched on. And public procurement as measure or a means of increasing innovation. Thank you.
I can hear you are working with this daily. You want to come in? Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. Can I just quickly deal with the decadal plan issue that the chairperson raised on the plan, how far we are with it?
The decadal plan, yeah, it has not been responded to.
Yes, I would like to respond to that.
Okay.
The plan for now is that we'll have a draft one that will be presented to government structures, including Parliament, around end of July 2020. There's still processes to consult the public.
What are you saying?
Sorry?
What are you saying? You're going to present to the government structures in 2020?
Yes.
July?
Yes. We have other consultation
processes.
Okay,
just finish first then.
Yes.
I'll come in.
There's other consultation processes to still want to consult with the provinces, the large metros, business and civil society between now and around April 2020, and then analyze those public comments between that April period and July, when we can come to the public, to the government structures.
So why were we promised October, end of October?
Okay,
the other DDG wants to
2020.
Comment.
Okay.
Chair, to add on to that, the decadal plan, I'm not too sure where the October time frame come in. I think we were looking more earlier in the year, not necessarily October. But the decadal plan in the current way...
So you don't know where October comes from?
October?
You don't know where it comes from?
No, because our timing, taking into account the elections and the fact that we needed to do a lot of consultations, we expected it to be earlier than June, but not necessarily by October. I think that would have been very difficult to get the kind of ownership of this document. The key to the decadal plan is that we're wanting to make sure that it's not a DSI document, that it's a document that is owned by other government departments, it's owned in an explicit way by business, etc. So there's a lot of ownership that we want to create for that document, and we also want to make sure that the decadal plan responds in a much more explicit way to government priorities at the moment. So part of the June deadline has been also informed by the master plans, where the time frames now that government has agreed on is that those master plans will be finalized by June next year. We also have the MTSF that was only recently finalized. It makes some important provisions that we're wanting to incorporate. So taking into account all of those different factors into account, we have said that the more ideal time frame would be June 2020.
Okay, it's fine. I think the other questions we've responded to, I don't know whether you... I want to comment on this DKL plan, but I want you to finish first.
Oh, okay, thanks, Chairperson. The other comment was on the appointment of CEOs that the member was worried that is it currently people just appoint without the minister knowing. It hasn't happened, but the provisions as they are now, they make it possible for that to happen should one want to do that, because there's nothing binding on their side. So we're trying to tighten that up, that it doesn't give that room for any board to be able to do that in the future. And I think in the presentation where there's tables, it would refer you to which sections in any of those acts
where there are changes with regard to that, and give the proper wording what is proposed in the bill. And the other request or maybe question or that I would like to maybe check with the chairperson and the committee is that maybe a way forward in terms of how we go ahead with this bill. I don't know if maybe the chairperson would kind of guide us, so that I don't know whether the chairperson would like us to go through clause by clauses, or we just take it as we tabled now with the amended clause, then we can proceed with that and we'll get the guidance from the chairperson.
Okay. All right. Now, the bill, we take it as being processed. You have taken us through what it says, basically it's harmonizing and standardizing the issues. So we'll have to present it to the committee and listen what the committee says, whether approve or not approve, and from which we'll then take it to the ATC. There is a report that has been attached, actually, which I'm going to ask that the committee must reflect on that report and see whether we adopt. So that is our process as a committee. The decadal plan, so the October target date does not come from the sky. It comes from our engagement with the department. When we were presented with the, when we requested a briefing on the white paper on science and technology. So during that engagement, which was presented by the DG, which was presented by the DG, and where some of you were there. Now, what was very clear from that presentation was that what will operationalize the bill, not the white paper, is the decadal plan. So I remember asking a question, when do you intend to finalize, to get the necessary approval from cabinet? So we're told not later than October. That's why we had to schedule it in our program, that we are going to receive that briefing. When was the date? Yeah. Oh, it was today. Yes. That's why we had to schedule it to today. Because we thought that by October we should be done with all the approval processes internally in the executive. So we had to move it because we were told that you are not yet ready. So I think we'll have a discussion with the DG. Because you see, when you come to the committee, you present what is concrete, if you come to present something that is still in discussion, you must also say so, like the R&D proposals, the scenarios, these are emerging thoughts, so to speak. So we understand it like that. But when you come to us to say, we should be ready, we will be ready by end of October. And now all of a sudden you come back and say, no, we don't know where the end of October was coming from. Maybe you're hallucinating, you guys. You were daydreaming. Actually, we will be ready by July 2020. So I don't know what that means, because I can tell you about myself. When these presentations are happening, I listen very carefully. When we answer questions, we get responses. I can tell you that is also minuted. If we don't know where it comes from, we can give you the minutes of that meeting. So I'm not asking you to rush it. I'm saying when you come and make commitments here, you must be clear in your mind about what you say, what you tell us, what commitments are you making. Because you are speaking to us, the public representatives. We take our work very seriously. So I think we deserve an explanation about this decadal plan. So we must ask the DG to explain to us the reasons for the delay and why that commitment was made, and all of a sudden it's no longer January or February, it's now June or July. Because that is going to operationalize all these plans in the department. It will help you to rethink, reimagine the future, the issue of a fourth industrial revolution and all of that. So when you delay it, I think we need to get some explanation there about that one. So I think we are done, honorable members. We are done. DDG is raising her hand. I don't know whether it's a point of order or what is it. Okay, what is it?
It's not a point of order, Chairperson. My apologies, it's a request regarding the SNT amendment bill. In our deliberation with the previous committee, there were clauses where they rejected our proposal, and one of them is the limitation of the term of office. So I don't know whether Chairperson would like us to propose the original or the one that the committee had agreed on.
I don't know what that request is about. Isn't it things are discussed before this thing comes here? Yeah? Because I was under the impression that we take the bill as been processed, because it was just about to be adopted by the House, and then the fifth parliament had to rise. So that was, now it has been revised. So what we do, we don't redo the whole thing because it was done. So all what we do, we have been briefed. We're going to put it to the committee and get approval, and then we go back to the House as it is. So if you want to, for the committee, this committee to make amendments, it means we'll have to restart the process, do clause by clause, and I'm not sure whether we're serious about what you want us to do, or you understand the implications of the request. But we've got the chief state law advisors here. Maybe they can just comment on that.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning.
Yeah, introduce yourself,
okay.
The two of you.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. My name is Adela. I'm from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. Before the new parliament, the bill, and that was at the beginning of the year, March 2019, the bill was considered, a list was prepared with the amendments. So I don't know if Shanaz is made available to the committee, but there is now a B bill which reflects the changes. And again, the changes that were made were to ensure that there is uniformity with regards to the disqualification of members of boards of councils, the term of office of the CEO. So everywhere there is uniformity, and it is, like the committee pointed out, it's governance issues, and yes, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I am Sue Ann Isaac, Parliamentary Legal Advisor. Chairperson, I think the question is about the processing of the bill and as to how, what this committee must do. I think because of the fifth parliament that ended without passing or adopting this bill, the issue is now what should happen. So it's been referred back to this committee to basically endorse what the other committee had done, and they agree with that and they're fine. If the committee wants to consider amendments, then the process will have to start again because the committee will have to apply its mind to what has been requested and as to what the other committee had agreed to and to why. But the previous committee had done its deliberations, applied its mind, and made decisions as to what to accept and what to reject, and there was a basis as to why they had rejected certain clauses and why they amended the bill in a certain way. So that committee had completed its process. So this committee is free to consider new amendments, but it will have to start again and consider from the public submissions. It cannot just make decisions without having the process run. So I think at this stage, the committee is just endorsing the previous work of the committee so the bill can go back to the House for the House to adopt it again. So it's at this stage, it's merely a procedural issue.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. The lawyers can go on and on, I know. look, the briefing I got is that this bill has been processed. There are no major issues that are being introduced by the bill. As you say, it's harmonized, regularized, and all of that. So the previous committee had dealt with this clause by clause, considering the amendment, changing, approving. There is all the lists in the process of development of legislation. What do you call it? What A list, and then there is a B list. All that has been done by the previous committee. So that's why it has been revived for us to adopt, take it to the House, and the House approves. Yesterday, we adopted the Foreign Service Bill in the National Assembly, which has gone through a similar process. It's something that was done in the past, revived by the Committee on DERCO, Portfolio Committee. It was presented yesterday, debated, approved. Now, I don't know what you are suggesting, DDG. I don't know what the suggestion is, because you simply want us to start afresh because you could not get what you wanted in the previous committee. You disagreed with what the previous committee did. Now, I don't think it's right. That would be very responsible of us to do. So you are asking us to do something that is very responsible because you want to have a second bite. So I think there is a report, members. It's a very short report, very, very brief. There are two reports, actually. In your packs. You didn't send it. Okay. Apparently, it has been sent out. But there's two reports that you have to approve. The first one is the convention that you have been briefed on. We have to approve that one so that it can be 80 seat. It goes to the House. We debate. If the House agrees, we approve. And then there is a bill. So the first one, I'm sure this one has been distributed. It's the convention one. Not yet. Okay, let me just read it. It's just a very small report. Brief report. It's the report of the Portfolio Committee on Science, on Higher Education, Science and Technology, on the agreement that the long name. Says the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education, Science and Technology, having considered the agreement between the Republic of South Africa and the International Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology on the establishment of an international center for genetic engineering and biotechnology component in the Republic of South Africa, as well as the exemplary memorandum of the agreement referred to, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, 1999, approve the said agreement. So this is a very brief report. So can I put this report for members to reflect on? Honorable Notada?
Sure, I think it's very important for us to receive that report. I think I had a small, brief discussion just to get a better understanding of it, because we obviously were not in the previous term. So it's quite important for us to get it. And I know it's very short and it's very specific just for our own...
this is the convention.
Yeah.
As I've read it, that is the report. Just as what I said. It doesn't...
We just want to check the English, Chair. It's correct.
Okay, the English is
joking, but
we
need to receive it, and we need to consult.
Okay, let's do
well,
it yeah. Then next week. Is it fine next week, Tuesday? It will just be distributed. You'll check everything. It's fine, and then we'll approve it. Okay. I'll give Honorable Dodada, my copy. You can check it. It's just a straightforward, it's just basically the convention. So maybe even the bill, let's put the bill for adoption next week. Is it fine? On Tuesday. It's also a small one. It has got five points, which I was going to read, but it has not been distributed. It's fine. I accept. Let's deal with it next Tuesday. Mananiso.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. With regards to the bill, as we'll be engaging on it for next week, can members go through whatever that was given to us? Because your comments, they are so important that we cannot restart the process.
Okay. Basically, we're just formalizing it because it has processed. Now, the processing of the bill, members, is quite involved.
Yeah.
It's very, very involved. I don't know whether we were... You know, I was a bit perplexed that we were taking that direction. Something that is very involved, and it was done. So when you are a successor in title, you take everything that has been done. But of course, in the House, it's going to be debated. All the views will be expressed, and then the House will then have to consider that. So let's consider the two reports then next week. What's happening next week? The sitters. Yeah, so we'll just 10 minutes or so before the sitters, we'll just consider these reports. Okay, thank you very much, honorable members. The meeting is adjourned.